NTJ Morning Magazine is continuing now. Good morning to you. I'm Rick Shepherd, and on the studio line this morning is Bruce Murray, who has authored the book Religious Liberty in America, The First Amendment in Historical and Contemporary Perspective. Thank you very much for being on the program.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. And congratulations on getting that whole title out there. That's quite a lot of words.
It is a lot of words, but the words say it all. It is a very interesting, very entertaining book. I like how you kicked it off in your foreword, mentioning the town of South Pasadena, where there is a church row, several different denominational churches side by side, living together peaceably, and how unusual that would have seemed to our founding fathers and early citizens, because they lived during a time of religious stress, right?
That's right. We take this for granted. In fact, I was just listening this morning to a show about upcoming changes on the U.S. Supreme Court or pending changes with resignations. And we have a Supreme Court whose members are the majority of whom are Catholic. And back in the early days of this country, this would have been unimaginable. But today, it's barely controversial.
Well, I read in the book that you could not, in some of the colonies, you could not serve in a political office unless you signed a piece of paper that said that you agreed with the beliefs of the predominant denomination at the time, which I believe was the Congregationalists.
Yeah, that's right. In New England, the Congregationalists were predominant. Of course, Pennsylvania was a notable exception, not part of New England, but Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Rhode Island were exceptions to this rule. And then in the South, from Virginia South, you had the Old Dominion, the Anglican Episcopal Church going back to England. Another thing that we don't really think about much today, we think of the South as being largely Baptist, but in those days it was very much connected with the Church of England.
One of the chapters I think I liked the most out of your book was the one titled Understanding the People of Faith. And it brought out the idea that if you are not a religious person, if you're not a person of faith, you really don't understand how religious people in this country think and how they perceive the nation and their role in the nation. And if you are not, if you are a media person, for example, and not a person of faith, then you likewise don't understand how religious people in America think. If you're not part of the club, so to speak, then you're kind of out of the loop. Is that right?
Yeah, that's actually where that chapter started in the first edition of this book was after all those words that you managed to get out in the beginning. There was an earlier version of this book called The First Amendment in the Newsroom and Beyond. And it was tailored specifically for journalists in the newsroom contending with this issue after September 11th. And yes, as it turns out, the newsroom is a very secular place, and as it should be. But sometimes in that hustle and bustle, the religion beat gets forgotten, and people miss a few things in the process, and that was actually the primary aim of the first version of this book, and you've picked up on it very well as a journalist that theme is still a part of the current edition.
I'm no expert, of course, but my perception of the media and religious news is that whenever there's a religious story in the newspaper, for example, it's only a featurey type of story. It's a story about how they're redecorating this church here, or they have a new program for kids over here. But there's never really a hard-hitting journalistic look at how religious people think, how they vote, and how that is impacting our nation. Do you think that's a fair statement?
Yeah, that's right. If that, what you listed as, you know, the little notation of what happens in the community, if that these days with the state of at least newspapers, which is where I come from, the state of them today is they've downsized and cut staff so much, you barely see coverage of religion and religious issues anymore. And it was not easy to find even in earlier times back in the 90s when I was working for newspapers. It wasn't easy to find a newspaper that really gave good coverage to these issues.
One of the other things you brought out in the book that I thought was very interesting is an idea that many people have around the world, that as we have grown more scientific and our technology has increased, that has led to a decrease in religiosity. You can see this in some European countries, but over here in America, it seems to be just the opposite. We have not decreased our religious fervor, our religious feelings in this country, despite the fact that technology and scientific understanding has increased, right?
That's right. The U.S. has bucked the trend in that regard. It's counterintuitive. The U.S., of course, is a fairly highly developed and advanced industrial nation with a huge scientific community, but yet we remain in the Western world the most religious among nations in the Western world. So why is that? And I correlate, and this is where the First Amendment comes in. I correlate this in my book with the First Amendment and this within our government, or the way our government is set up, the separation of church and state, in contrast to the countries in Europe, which still, believe it or not, have established churches. The Anglican Church, the Church of England, of course, is the established church in England, and you have these different forms of establishment in Germany and Scandinavia, where you can sort of pick and choose which denomination that your taxes will support. And that we did away with that idea early on in the U.S., and that has enabled churches and religion to flourish free of the whims and constraints of government.
Let's talk a little bit about public schools in America and religious issues. I think that many school administrators are not well-versed in matters of religion and the legal process, and the easiest thing for them to do is to say, okay, let's not have any religion at all so we don't get into any legal problems whatsoever. So you can't do this, and you can't do that, and you can't do that over there, and you have to stop doing this over here. But that's not necessarily the best solution to the problem, right?
Yeah, that's right. And on the side of the administrators and school board members, erring on the side of caution, well, they've seen, and you read my book, you see lawsuit after lawsuit involving public schools. So from the standpoint of school superintendent, the president of the school board, you're just better off staying away from this and saving your school district a lot of money paying for legal fees. The problem with that is, in the process of this, sometimes they've allowed the pendulum to swing too far to curtail perhaps the religious liberty of their students, or to completely expunge any mention of religion or religious studies from curriculum, when this is something that should really be an essential part of the study of history and sociology in this country, because religion, of course, was such an important influence.
We should point out that in the case of people who deal with this problem, like, for example, school administrators, they don't necessarily get a lot of help from the Supreme Court. There has been no sweeping law from the high court on how to deal with something like this. An example, the ACLU might complain about a manger scene being set up on a public square someplace, and the Supreme Court will issue in one instance one way and another instance another way. At first, it'll say, well, okay, you can have that, but it has to be smaller than that. It can't be that big. Okay, the Christmas tree can stay, and the Santa Claus can stay, but you have to put it over here. You know, it's all kind of a case-by-case basis from the high court. There's a comment in your book about one of the justices saying that they feel less like a Supreme Court justice and more like an interior decorator. And people, Americans who are looking to the Supreme Court to give them guidance in this issue, walk away scratching their head saying, what exactly is the law?
Rick, you've very well summarized the case of Allegheny County versus ACLU in your neighborhood. And that particular case, which was involving Christmas trees and menorahs and things like this, became very convoluted. And so I can very much understand from the standpoint of your listeners and people in that area that this would just be maddening, because that was a very maddening case. And I touch on that in my book. And this was a case of the Supreme Court trying or in many other cases, of the Supreme Court trying to find a broad and general rule and a principle, you know, as lawyers do, or as judges do, they look for a principle in the law and try and apply it. And in this case, it just became a terrible mess. And they're still searching for ways to get out of that mess and to find a broad principle of law that they can apply across the board and make work and not sound or not be so incredibly confusing as the Allegheny County case was. And you actually see a movement on the court to try and do this. They're actually really grappling with a way to find some way out of becoming local regulators and getting into the zoning, you know, the local zoning issues of cities and counties. So there may be a more coherent vision coming out of the court, but at least they seem to be working on it.
Well, let me ask you one more question now before I let you go, and that is, what does the future hold for the idea of religiosity in America? We've been at it now for more than 200 years. You think we have would figure everything out by now, but it's been a very rocky road so far. In your opinion, what does the future hold?
That's a very, very good question, Rick. And let me see, where to begin? I think the U.S. will continue to be to buck the trend among nations, as I call it in my book, alone among nations. I think the U.S. will be very different from our peers in Europe in this regard. The U.S. will continue to be a more religious nation than others in the Western world. We're still grappling very, very deeply with this issue of separation of church of state and just how deeply the government gets involved with that vis-a-vis the Supreme Court. That's something we're going to see continuing in the news over the years, and with the Supreme Court changing, with new members coming on, you're going to see new perspectives regarding that issue. The court seems to be moving away from, I think they want to get away from the over-regulation of local issues. So I think they're looking for a way to pull back from that. I think that's something that we'll see in the future in this regard. There are so many other issues. It's very interesting to see that Barack Obama has continued the faith-based initiative program that came out of the Bush administration. His Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives has basically continued under Barack Obama's administration under a slightly new name. It's not something you see a lot of in the news, but it continues. Many issues going on.
Once again, we have been speaking with author Bruce Murray, who has written Religious Liberty in America, the First Amendment in Historical and Contemporary Perspective. Always a fascinating topic. And Bruce, you have a fascinating book here. Thank you very much for the book. Thank you very much for your time on the program today.
Thank you very much, Rick.